This day, you would be with us as we reflect on experiences of pain and loss, the ways that gets expressed to you. We ask you to meet us in this time, be present in our conversation, and help us to hear your word. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, well, welcome to all of you once again to Bible study. Great to see you here. And thanks for coming for this day that doesn't have such a cheery catch title for it. We're looking at Psalms of Disorientation today. For those who were who've been here, we talked yesterday a little bit about this scheme of looking at the Psalms through sort of three different movements or three different kind of lenses that the Psalms work in. And this is a scheme worked out by scholar Walter Brueggemann, thinking about Psalms of orientation, disorientation, and new orientation. So yesterday we spoke about Psalms that express something of kind of the givenness of life, the stability of creation, the way that God has provided order and life through various means. Particularly yesterday we looked at that through Psalms giving thanks for the Torah, for God's wisdom and guidance for life. Given to the people of Israel. We also looked at Psalms of creation that talk about that kind of order and vitality in the created world that creates a sense of stability and orientation for life. Life isn't always like that, however. We experience other things in life. And the Psalms are very, very honest about that. And so there's a very large category of the Psalms that speak more about disorientation than they do about orientation. And that's one of these big movements in the Psalms. If you open up the book of Psalms, as I'm sure most of you know, you don't have to go far at all to find Psalms that are expressing very difficult human emotions of anger and pain and loss. Psalms speaking about a world that's become disoriented in some sense. So today we're going to look at some of those Psalms, and tomorrow we'll look at another category of Psalms that look at God's movement within that experience of disorientation, finding a new orientation for life. And there is a continuity among all of these three movements. It's not that they're exactly watertight categories, but we'll get more to that tomorrow. So today, looking at this experience of disorientation that we find in the Psalms, one of the main categories for this are Psalms of Lament. That's one of the primary ways that disorientation gets expressed in the Psalms. Can anybody here just give us a little bit about what do you understand lament to mean? What is that about? Anyone?
Pain, yeah. And sorrow.
Pain and sorrow. Mm-hmm. Right.
A grieving process.
Yep. Can be all of those
anger
things.
Sometimes.
Absolutely. It can come across as anger sometimes. That's exactly right. All of these things. So it's often a powerfully honest expression of these difficult human experiences to God. Like I say, they take up a huge section of the Psalter. I wish I'd actually done the math to say how many psalms deal in this language, but it's a huge number. If you look at our hymnal, ELW that we just sang from, I think there are 8 or 9 lament psalms among the 800 hymns in there. It's a much smaller ratio than in the Book of Psalms. We're not always, I think, as a culture, terribly comfortable with this posture of speaking to God as a community and as individuals. And we'll talk some about that, but any initial thoughts on why we're not always as comfortable with this? I mean, if somebody were to look at our hymnal, I think they wouldn't see lament as one of the primary, who knew nothing about the faith, they would not see lament as one of the primary ways that we speak to God. It takes up a tiny sliver of the hymnal. Why are we often not so comfortable with this kind of language? Yeah, go ahead.
Because of the tendency of America to be U.S. especially, not so recently, but to be this optimistic, we can overcome all adversity kind of thing. We don't have time for that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah. It seems too negative, not optimistic enough or something, right? That's part of it. Yep.
Well, and then specifically as Lutherans, our response to creation and our response to grace is praise, worship, thanksgiving, much more positive than, sitting back and saying, woe is me. We almost feel guilty if we sit back and say, oh, I really have it tough. I mean, we're taught that you don't really have it so tough after all.
Right, and there's something, of course there's something right about that, that our primary response to God's grace, those who were at Michael's session last night, our primary response to that is gratitude toward God and a living out of right relationships with one another. But then what does it do to these experiences that are part of human life that we then sometimes ignore? Yeah?
It delegitimizes, makes us feel, as some he said, guilty, and it delegitimizes them. How many times have I gone to the mental health counselor, told them all about my problems, and they said, okay, what are you going to do now about it?
Right.
Okay, by the way, I'm coming from a Jewish viewpoint, and we're going to be going into three-week period of mourning because of our national calamities that happens every summer, starting this Jewish month of Tammuz.
Right.
And partially that's why I'm here today.
Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate that. Yeah.
My friend over there had an insight I heard at breakfast this morning. He had his billfold stolen 3 times in Paris, and they steal billfolds from Americans, he said. And how can they tell who Americans are? And he said, they can tell who Americans are because they're always smiling. So it must be hard for Americans to lament if we're always smiling.
That's I think there's something to that. I mean, it is sort of a culture that values optimism and sort of putting on a good face, and even in times of adversity. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's the only story you told about this morning.
On the other hand, we do have a lot of depression in our country.
Yep.
Right.
A lot of alienated people, and we all die.
Yeah.
Sometimes we can't ignore the reality.
Oh, and I agree. Yeah.
I think many of us human beings have a very challenging time being vulnerable and saying we're not in control of everything.
Yeah.
And it's painful to realize your vulnerability.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it can also be a gift if it's shared.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, and I think that is one of the great, that's a great transition into actually looking at some of these psalms. They are very, very vulnerable words. You see kind of a dark side of human nature in some of these psalms, and that's, I think, that vulnerability is part of their value in our
I just wanted
canon.
To say that it just seems like it's just not okay to question God, why you did this to me, and I'm not supposed to question it. And I remember so well that the movie Fiddler on the Roof, when Tevye was always saying, God, why are you doing this to me?
Right.
That was never raised to even think about questioning.
To speaking that way.
It was a part of Jewish tradition.
I know. It was very refreshing to me to hear that.
Yeah. Interesting to think about why that's not part of a lot of Christian tradition, that the ability to do that. So, real briefly, sometimes in a lot of these lament psalms, the form is not maybe quite as precise as some of the ones we looked at yesterday. We looked at a couple of psalms where there was a really deliberate attention, it seemed, to aesthetics and form that helped to draw out the meaning of the psalm. Often the psalms of lament express something very immediate and visceral, and it's not always quite so neatly put together. But sometimes, I mean, there still are elements of form that help us understand the meaning of the psalms. And a couple of things, the scholars tend to think that psalms of disorientation tend to contain at least these two elements, and that's a plea and some form of praise, although this one is complicated. Some of the psalms have, the praise is sort of hidden or not phrased in the way that we often think of praise taking place. So there are a couple that actually almost, I think, omit it entirely, a couple of the very kind of darkest psalms in the Psalter. But within the plea, I want to just write down a few things that are a part of this, and we'll notice these in one form or another within the psalms we're looking at today. The plea includes an address to God. That's a key aspect there, addressed to God. They include a complaint, so an expression of, you know, God, this is what's wrong. A petition, so a demand that God act, do something about what's wrong. A motivation, and this is often a really interesting part of these psalms, is why God should act. Sometimes there's a whole variety of reasons why the person might say, God, you need to do something about this. And we'll see a couple different ones within that category. And finally, this is often the part that's toughest for us to stomach, and they sometimes gets called imprecation or a cursing. So often a wish for something terrible to happen to the enemies, to those that the person is in conflict with. Yeah.
We read in them. We traditionally before Shabbat services, read something. Actually, all morning services read something called Suke de Zim, the Suke de Zimra, which means words of praise, and two of the last ones, and two of the later ones end with one of them, ends with to see their kings, referring to the kings of the godless peoples around Israel,
yep,
wrapped up and bought, put in chains, and their princes in irons,
yeah,
for the judgment that has been decreed against them.
Right. So it's often can be very vivid language in this last category, and often that's the stuff that I think it can be hardest for us to know what to do with. Sometimes it can feel really in conflict with other aspects of our faith, and we'll talk about that. We'll see it in these psalms that we're looking at, and then praise being sort of this other subcategory here. So plea often includes all of these things. And they're not often in a very neat order. I mean, sometimes they're kind of mixed together, jumbled around a bit, but these are sort of the different things going on within these psalms. So we're going to, if you'd like to open your Bibles, we will look at Psalm 143 first. This is a fairly standard, I guess, psalm of lament that includes a lot of these elements that we're talking about. And this is one from the perspective of an individual person.
Psalm
Has everyone had a chance to find that? Would somebody be willing to read that psalm for us? We'll do the, please read the entire thing. It's verses 1 through 12.
I'll read it.
That'd be great.
Hear my prayer, O Lord. Give ear to my supplications in your faithfulness. Answer me in your righteousness. Do not enter into judgment with your servant, for no one living is righteous before you. For the enemy has pursued me, crushing my life to the ground, making me sit in the darkness like those long dead. Therefore, my spirit faints within me, my heart within me is appalled. I remember the days of old. I think about all your deeds. I meditate on the works of your hands. I stretch out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land. Answer me quickly, O Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, or I shall be like those who go down to the pit. Let me hear of your steadfast love in the morning, for to you I put my trust. Teach me the way I should go, for to you I lift up my soul. Save me, O Lord, from my enemies. I have fled to you for refuge. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit lead me on a level path. For your name's sake, O Lord, preserve my life. In your righteousness, bring me out of trouble. In your steadfast love, cut off my enemies and destroy all my adversaries, for I am your servant.
All right. Well, first, any initial reactions to hearing that? Initial reactions to the language or to the form of that psalm, to just the way it strikes you today?
Verse 4 really speaks to me, and my translation says, so my spirit grows faint within me. My heart within me is dismayed, just that utter despair. I'm so weary. I feel so weary.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was struck in the end of verse 11. In your righteousness, bring me out of trouble. God, if you really are a just God,
right.
You know, I shouldn't be suffering from this cancer,
right.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And that's interesting you bring up this cancer or something. I mean, it does, the specifics of the situation aren't all there. We don't know all the who, what, when, where's of this. So it can be applied to a whole variety, like many of the Psalms, to situations. That's right. Yep.
I get the impression of generally saying, I do the right thing, so I'm a good guy. And would you hurry up and save me, help me, destroy my enemies, and do it now. He goes through all this stuff of what he does and how he expects some help.
It also seems like it's just a very honest prayer of faith. Let me hear of your steadfast love in the morning, for in you I put my trust. Teach me the way I should go, for to you I lift up my soul.
Right.
This is a very prayerful, loving prayer.
Right. I think that's an important observation. So we're already getting at a lot of this, but I think I see all of these categories present in this psalm at one place or another. And pointing these out isn't just an exercise to hide and seek kind of exercise within the psalm, but I think it can help us bring out some of the meaning of what's going on here. And both then what it, those two questions that we thought about yesterday in terms of what does this say about who God is and what does it, how can it stretch and enrich our prayer lives? Finding these different aspects, I think, can help us to get at the meaning of some of those things. So an address to God, where do we see that? In the psalm.
What? Verse 1.
Yeah, verse 1. And I actually see it kind of throughout as well. I mean, there, time after time, God's named, and with different qualities of who God is, naming God as righteous, naming God as one of steadfast love, kind of happens throughout the psalm as well, I think.
And
imperatives, the very clear cut formulaic imperatives.
And which of those categories would that be? That's like the
petition.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that as right throughout. I saw verse 1, 2, and then really 7 through 12. I mean, throughout there are these questions or these imperatives. Hear my prayer, do not enter into judgment. Answer me, do not hide your face. Let me hear, teach me, save me, teach me. It's constant, huge number of imperatives. That's right. In terms of the complaint, we don't get a great detail exactly, but where do we see that?
Verse three.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
4. And 4 too. Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
9.
Did you say 9?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Okay. And in terms of motivation in this one, what are the, I think it does come in a number of places in this psalm. Why should God answer this prayer? Why should God act?
Nobody's righteous.
Uh-huh. Yep. Calling on God's nature as righteous. That's like verse 11 there, right?
2.
Verse 2, did you say also? Yep.
5 looks like it. I remember the days of old. I think about all your deeds.
Yep.
I think I meditate on the work of your hands. So.
Yep. I agree. I sort of see the motivation, more or less happening throughout in different ways.
Don't you see, I think it's kind of odd, though, in verse 12, where the writer says, because you're such a loving God, kill all those people.
That's
the motivation for killing them, because you're a loving God.
Right, and that's that's tough. That's really tough. But it seems to be the argument, right?
Verse 10, for you are my God.
You are my God. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Verse 12, I am your servant.
All of those things. So it's sort of drawing on a past relationship with God. This is who we've been. You've been my God. I've been your servant. I know that you are righteous and steadfast in your love. So these are all. It's calling on kind of past experience and knowledge of God throughout.
Andy, I wonder if I'm just putting this out of the air, but in the covenant understanding of things, way back then, and which kind of carried over to the feudal world, that the lord and the slave, or the peasant, or that there was a relationship, there was an understanding that there'll be mutual service, mutual commitment, which carried into later in the 1800s in England, where the aristocracy felt very compelled to take care of the people who had been working on their estates for generations.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that there is this covenant deal that has been cut in blood.
I've held up my end of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There was this inborn expectation that the covenant requires me to be faithful to God and God to be faithful to me.
Yeah.
And in that, I have peace in the world. I can live, I can breathe, it's a sanity saver.
Right, right, right. That's absolutely.
There's also the unspoken assumption that if God doesn't demonstrate how benevolent he is to his subjects, then he's not really the greatest God. If your enemies prosper and God's subjects decline, then God's not the best God on the block.
Right, right. It's tough stuff. Yeah. Okay, and of course then we've got that the cursing or wishing for ill on the enemies, I guess primarily in verse 12.
How do you deal with those things? Like when I'm feeling something in worship, I just cut them out. It just really bothers me because it's not part of my theology.
To wish for ill on others. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Well, I think that is one of the big questions I hope we can talk about together today, because I have some thoughts, but I think if maybe we can hold that a little bit. We're going to look at some more psalms too that are going to deal with this in slightly different ways. But I think that is maybe one of the big question. And I think verse 12, in a way, is holding that right there, as you pointed out. It's calling on God's steadfast love to to wreak vengeance on my enemies. I mean, that. How do we hold that together?
Yeah.
or not. And do we see praise in the psalm at all, in any form? Yeah. Say more.
Well, verse 5.
Yep.
I remember the days of long ago.
Yep. Huh?
And pay for to you, I lift up my soul.
Yep. It's kind of woven throughout in this one. There's sort of this sort of back and forth between praising God for these qualities of who God is. And remembering God's past deeds. I think that's exactly right. So in that sense, I think there's kind of a continuity with the Psalms of order, of orientation that we talked about yesterday, right? It's not abandoning who we knew that God to be. It's actually really relying on who the person knew that God to be, who'd created an ordered world and created a possibility for life, sort of calling on that same God in the situation where things are a mess. Does that make sense? Is that?
I think verse 8 is that way a lot. If you just read verse 8 only by itself, you don't even necessarily realize this is a lamentation psalm, except for the word cause or help, or however it may be translated. Help me to remember that I'm supposed to be watching for your loving kindness. Help me to remember these things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see. Maybe we could. I mean, let's address that question a little bit, Nancy. Your question about how do we end up praying a psalm this way? I mean, do we if we're praying this in a community or on our own? Do we kind of clip off the last verse, or do we? What happens when we do pray that?
For your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I talked with Danny about this yesterday. I've been struggling with this intensely, personally, the last 2 months. My older daughter's husband of 18 months, all of a sudden, out of the blue, turned to the dark side and dumped her. And he's been stabbing in the back the last 2 months. My wife and I have been just shredded by this. And so I go to the Psalms. And there's something about some of these Psalms that are dealing with enemies that I don't know what to do with exactly. Because in one, I still love my son-in-law, and on the other hand, I'm furious with him for what he's doing to himself, to his own parents, my daughter, to our dreams that we've had for this marriage and grandchildren and all. He's dishonoring himself, my daughter. Anyway, so what do you do? So I have actually begun to pray some of these imprecatory psalms. I don't know, I've never in my entire life done this. And my wife and I were talking about this last night. I was reading in Romans last night, Romans 12, Paul says, treat your enemy well, Jesus said this too, because you'll be heaping coals on his head. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And the songwriter sort of wants to play on that, wants to depend upon that there is justice in the universe, there will be just deserts dealt to those who are wicked, which is another word that's very common in the Psalter. And that sort of, to me, is a pressure relief valve to pray that God's justice will be dealt to my son-in-law. He will get his comeuppance. I will not be the one to do it, which is Paul and Jesus. Yeah. I will not be the one to deal it out. That's God's domain. But I think, I'm just, you can help me here, because I'm really wrestling with this. There is a certain dimension of faith that demands righteousness, that demands justice. Not that I'm going to be the one to hire a hitman, although I have thought. my son is that I wish this were legal. He could hire a hitman.
So appreciate your honesty and opening that up a little bit. I mean, and I think what you said right there about, I mean, in the New Testament, it's understood as left to God's, ultimately left to God's judgment. I mean, that too.
So does David. David thinks the same thing.
He's going to say exactly in the Psalms.
He's appealing to God to do what God does. God is not only gracious, but he's also righteous. And there's the wrath of God to contend with. Mm-hmm. I think to leave either one out emasculates God. Not emasculates, that's the wrong word. Truncates or diminishes, dwarfs God.
Yeah.
Because he is a God of wrath, justice will be done. Otherwise, moral chaos reigns. eventually it will be done. And the psalmist wants to hurry it up.
Yeah.
And maybe there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe that's okay, as long as we take our hands off the instruments of righteousness, of justice and wrath, right, and let God handle that, because our motives are way too mixed up for us to be at the helm, right, of any destroyer that's going to, right, rain bombs down upon the wicked.
Right. Right, you know, I mean, the psalmist never is saying, God watch me while I take up vengeance on this person. It's always a prayer that God be the one to act. But still, yep, I think the same is first in there.
Yeah, someone one time said that resentment or hatred towards another individual is like taking poison and expecting it to hurt the other person. What I was thinking about, though, is, you know, that all the 12-step programs talk about resentment as being the number one offender leading people that are alcoholics back to drinking and so forth. And so what I see this is doing is, you know, being honest with God. These are my feelings. And it's kind of letting go. You know, here it is, I'll pass it on. And you deal with it. You know, I don't have to.
Yep. So you can letting go. Yep.
I find in all of this, as I say, I can see him just complaining. I've done all these things right, fix it, help me, do it now. And then at the end he goes off. But verse 10, I think is to me very key, because after all these complaints and all this wanting to God to help him to do bad things to his enemies and protect him, 10 says, but teach me to do your will. In other words, and then he ends up and then complains again. But that verse really kind of hit me, is that through all of this complaint and all his righteousness and wanting action, he then comes in, but teach me, help me.
And isn't that very, very human, that it's not necessarily, that isn't in this, the last verse of the psalm. It sort of, I don't know if we want to think of it this way, but sort of regresses a little bit, goes back to, you know, wishing these other things. It's sort of, and I think in the human experience, that's sort of what it is. There may be some good motives in there mixed with just the raw, honest, this is what I feel. Yeah, complain. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
At our Bible camp, it's up in central North Dakota. They had a theme a few years back, pray always. Mm-hmm. Pray always. By extension, I have moved over to God is good always. God is good always. Then I think in terms of the benediction. Ben has the idea of good. Is that 100% good? The Lord bless you. Or is it only 99% good? And God has a 1% negative side. In contrast to the benediction, we don't have this, but I think of a malediction. There is no such, unless you look at the last verse here, a curse, and it's probably we who do the malediction rather than God. I think in terms of coming to peace with something like this on my own, where sin carries its own punishment, and that God is always on the good side, period.
Yeah.
Well, from a Jewish mystical point of view, Kabbalah, there's this concept that God had to withdraw him herself in order to make room for the rest of us, and therefore that's why there are, it's not the fault of God that they're bad things. God basically withdrew from part of, if everything was perfect, God would be everywhere and there would be no room for us as individual children of God. And as a result of God's withdrawal from part, from to make space for creation, things are, God is not everywhere, and therefore things aren't perfect. It's not because God's alive making things doing. God weeps and is very much hurt when things that are bad happen to us, but God, there's a limit. God, him herself, imposed a limit on what he, she can do in mm-hmm. order to make room for our free will.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sad thing when our free will and the fact that there are just certain things that as well as nature's tendency to do what it feels like doing,
mm-hmm.
basically start hurting.
Right, so can certainly get into the question of how evil exists in the world and big questions.
Right.
Any other? Yep.
Do we need to look at this writing within historical context and understand that the enemies of the particular writer are probably much more imminent and deadly than the enemies that we might think of when we read this? I mean, aren't we talking about people is the writer talking about people who could kill him? And as a result, need help from God to smite these people because they're a threat to me and my family.
Right. That's a great question. I think, you know, in some of the Psalms, it appears that there is a really, you know, imminent physical threat. In other ones, it's not so clear. And still, there are, I think, you know, often these wishes of quite horrible things happening to the enemy. I think that's a great question. I mean, does anybody have anything to offer on that? Or, yeah?
Well, we look at the Psalm and we see it's a Psalm of David. David, for quite a while, was basically a guerrilla fighter, hiding from Shaul, who had it in his mind to kill him. That's all there's to it. I mean, he may have been king of Israel later, but he started out, first of all, he was a mighty warrior against Philistines, the Philistines, and he killed that Goliath guy.
Mm-hmm.
But then Saul turned against him because of that problem. Because Saul knew that Saul's days were numbered because of a prophecy made by Shmuel. Shmuel, we call Samuel here,
mm-hmm.
several in some David, which is Hebrew for David. David basically went into hiding with a whole bunch, and he gradually attracted a whole bunch of guys who, as well as one or two women, who were basically like Abigail, who basically would be considered nothing more than terrorists today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that right, the experiences of David are woven throughout these. Whether all the Psalms attributed to David in the Psalms were actually written by David is a question that's
right.
much debated, of course. But part of the tradition of this individual, sure. Yeah. That's for you.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if when they're speaking of the enemies,
yeah.
is it always people that they're talking about, or could they be talking about like concepts? Like, could they just be talking about, you know, temptation or things like that, or is it always people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I don't have a lot of insight to that in terms of myself in terms of the historical, if we know exactly that, but I do know that often when people pray these regularly, they start to hear enemies in a different way. I mean, I've read reflections from a Benedictine who prays the Psalms daily and hears that term of enemy more in terms of you know, other things that are an enemy to that person's life, whether they be negative negative thoughts or negative habits or things like that. So there are different ways, however it was written, there are different ways to hear that language, I think. And I think that's a really good insight. Anybody else have insight on that particular question? Yeah.
I mean, a modern day enemy might be depression.
Absolutely.
I'm pursuing my soul, crushing my life to the ground, making me sit in darkness is all seem like...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. So I think that's a really good insight into how we may actually end up praying these.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I once saw a church marquee and to be a Lutheran church, and it said, "To hell with guilt," because that's where it belongs. that is a real enemy.
Condemning that enemy.
And
yeah.
that may be the biggest enemy in my life right now, to operate under guilt. I really appreciate that insight.
Yeah.
And I can see if you pray it long enough, you know, it will be a very beneficial thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, let's look at one more psalm that handles some of these themes in a different way. We're going to look at number 74, which is a psalm of a community's experience rather than individuals. And so deals with these things in a different way, but I think still a very important voice in the Psalms. And there are a number of Psalms that are dealing in this communal lament or experience of communal disorientation. So let's see, this one's a little bit longer. Maybe would somebody read the first 11 verses and then somebody read from 12 to the end? That'd be great. Thank you. Yep.
Oh God, why do you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your congregation, which you acquired long ago, which you redeemed to be the tribe of your heritage. Remember Mount Zion, where you came to dwell. Direct your steps to the perpetual ruins. The enemy has destroyed everything in the sanctuary. Your foes have roared within your holy place. They set up their emblems there. At the upper entrance, they hacked the wooden trellis with axes, and then, with hatchets and hammers, they smashed all its carved work. They set your sanctuary on fire. They desecrated the dwelling place of your name, bringing it to the ground. They said to themselves, "We will utterly subdue them." They burned all the meeting places of God in the land. We do not see our emblems. There is no longer any prophet, and there is no one among us who knows how long. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your hand? Why do you keep your hand in your bosom?
Yet God, my King, is from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. Thou didst divide the sea by thy might. Thou didst break the heads of the dragons on the waters. Thou didst crush the heads of Leviathan. Thou didst give him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. Thou didst cleave open springs and brooks. Thou didst dry up ever-flowing streams. Thine is the day, thine also the night. Thou hast established the luminaries and the sun. Thou hast fixed all the bounds of the earth. Thou hast made summer and winter. Remember this, O Lord, but how the enemy scoffs, and an impious people reviles thy name. Do not deliver the soul of thy dove to the wild beasts. Do not forget the life of the poor forever. Have regard for thy covenant, for the dark places of the land are full of the habitations of violence. Let not the downtrodden be put to shame. Let the poor and needy praise thy name. Arise, O God, plead thy cause, and remember how the impious scoff at thee all the day. Do not forget the clamor of thy woes, the uproar of the event of thy adversaries, which go up continually.
Thank you. So what's happened here? What's the what's this one? We do get a little bit more of kind of an immediate cause for the psalm, a little bit more of the story. What's happened here?
The destruction of the temple.
Yeah, it's not absolutely determined, but a lot of scholars believe this might have been written actually in exile in Babylon or around that experience, at least the experience of the temple in Jerusalem being destroyed. Okay, so it's sort of can anyone say a little bit about the role of the temple in Jerusalem? What would the loss of that temple mean? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was basically the loss. Basically, the temple was where all sacrifices were carried out.
Right.
Where basically, it was the dwelling place of God on earth.
Right.
And to have that thing lost wasn't it? Especially the first loss of it, and the second loss, both the first and the second loss, were a great blow to the good part of what Judaism stood for.
So it's sort of. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
But. And people, and on the other hand, it did cause a slow moving forward and a especially the second loss, which led to prayer as in place of sacrifice and other things. But when it first happened, it was basically, it was a crushing. I can't imagine how crushing the blow is. And nowadays, I think it was probably an idea that made that for religious progress was necessary. But at that point, and we still celebrate 3 weeks of national mourning for the destruction of both temples, and those 3 weeks will be starting in another 12 days or 30 days.
So maybe one way to think about it, sort of the loss of a center for the religion. I mean, sort of the focal point of God's dwelling, of the place of religious activity, all of that lost. So it's certainly a very traumatic and
it's basically like what happened if somebody bombed Mecca, destroyed the Kaaba, or somebody bombed St. Peter's Buddha, blew St. Peter's Church up for the Catholics.
Right, so the loss of a very central place. So where do we see some of these different aspects of the psalm going on in this psalm? Where do we see the address?
Really?
Verse 1.
Yeah, verse 1 again. Yep. So it begins with an address to God. And again, I think comes throughout, but the initial address, it's right off the beginning. That's who this is going up to, this prayer. In terms of the complaint, where do we see the complaint happening in this one? The sort of, you know, recitation of what happened, what's gone wrong?
Four and eight.
Really, four all the way through. I think 4 through 11, probably. Yeah. Yep. And that's all the way through. It's quite detailed. I mean, it's sort of, God, in case you didn't see, here's exactly what happened. Here's exactly what happened. You know, quite detailed in terms of exactly what they did to different, you know, parts of the temple. So, 4 through 8 sort of detailing what happened. 9 through 11 sort of detailing the desperateness of the current situation. There's no prophet among us who knows what's going on, how long this is going to happen. So what about petition, asking God to do something about it? Where do we find that coming in this one? 11.
Uh-huh. Hand out and destroy them.
That's there, right? Yep. Sort of in the rhetorical question, but why aren't you acting? Yep.
22, 23.
Yep. And I actually think probably 18 all the way through 23, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, calling on God to remember what's going on, to deliver, to remember the covenant. There's that covenant language again, that remember, you know, don't forget this. I think motivation's a really interesting one in this psalm. Where do we see a motivation for acting?
There are a lot of reminders of what God has done in the past.
Yep, yep.
He keeps saying, you did this, you did this, you did that, and then the natural consequence would be, so now do this.
So sort of
12, 13.
Yeah, almost through all of that, right? I mean, kind of 12 through 17. I mean, sort of recounting God's acts in history, God's acts in creation. Remembering all these ways that God has made life possible.
And then back in too, it says, remember the congregation you purchased.
Absolutely, yep.
It's interesting to me that from 12 to 19, it seems that God as creator, God as being sort of lifted up and praised and kind of called to account as creator.
Yeah.
That's almost, that seems to take precedence over the covenant relationship. The destruction of the temple was a sort of creation self becoming unhinged.
Ah, that's really good. And, yep. Yep.
And to kind of reassert that of sovereignty over creation of covenant.
Yep. Yep, sort of, right, the temple, yeah, the temple coming down, sort of like creation falling apart. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
The other thing that strikes me about that same section, it's almost reminiscent of the language that God uses with Job. Who are you? And did you lay the foundation of the earth? And I don't know. It's, I don't know where that goes. But it's sort of destructive. It's almost calling on that aspect of that language. Or that,
right.
That
right.
Role.
That's because Job was mimicking the Psalms when he made his statements. And I mean, it's a deliberate thing by the poet who wrote Job to reflect that language.
There's that in there, but then there's also God's very language to Job that's saying, too, you know, God's speaking back and saying, I don't remember the exact words, but I mean, did you create the seas? Did you, you know, have you tamed Leviathan?
But even a little twist in that,
yep.
That's kind of fun, that the psalm here expects that God's in control of Leviathan, where Job, it's sort of a, I like Leviathan on the loose. This is what's supposed to be happening.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think three times I see in here the petition not for a redress of the ill done to Israel, but the ill done to the name of God.
Yes. Yes.
So verse 10, how long will the enemy mock you, revile your name? The temple was the place where the name of God was displayed. And that's referred many times in the Old Testament. This is the place where your name dwells, the place where your name dwells. Yep. And it's the honor and reputation of God that's being threatened, just besmirched by what the enemy is doing to the temple. So it's
right.
not just for me that mm-hmm. I want redress. I want your name to be honored and lifted up among all nations.
Right. Look at verse 4. Whose enemies are these?
God's
enemies, right? So they're, I mean, it's sort of saying, my enemies are yours. They're threatening your honor and who you are. Yeah.
I don't know if 22 carries that or not, but he's just saying, you've done all these things, all these difficult things. Why don't you just rise up now and plead your case to
yeah.
the people?
Yep.
Give us teaching, give us... You've done the hard things. Now, why don't you do this and
yeah.
help us spread your word?
You created the seas. How big a deal is this?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When it comes to Job, God was probably saying to Job, in typical Jewish fashion, I can't control these things. Why do you think you can? It's not a case of... And that simply comes from what I talked about Kabbalah teaching. About mm-hmm. the doctrine of contraction or tzimtzum, which, mm-hmm. I mean, God said, I made it, I have a heck of a time trying to run creation. It's hard work. How do you think you can do it? I mean, God was basically complaining back to Job.
Right. Okay, so.
That's what Rabbi Kushner says, by the way. And
is that right?
When bad things happen to good people.
Uh huh. Yeah. Okay, so and then in terms of imprecation in this one, it's maybe not quite as explicit as in the other one, but kind of throughout, calling on the foes to be defeated, sort of throughout. And in terms of praise, how would you characterize that in the psalm? Do we see praise? What form does it take?
Well,
yeah.
Part of it is their verse where he's telling them all of these great feats that he's done in the
yeah.
past.
Yeah. So that's 12 through 17 there again?
Yeah.
Yep. That's where I saw it as well. Yeah, I agree with that. good. Well, so we've looked at a couple different voices on these experiences of disorientation. Brueggemann in his book says that that we often, he thinks one of the reasons we don't pray these sorts of psalms very often as congregations, as individuals, while we might be uncomfortable with them, is we're afraid that the praying them is an act of unfaith. And he disagrees with that. And I'm interested, how do you all come down on that question? Is praying these psalms with their language and their orientation, is that an act of faith or unfaith? Yeah.
I just think it takes a lot of nerve to call on God to keep up God's end of the contract when I myself haven't kept up my end. I think that's just kind of ballsy and probably. And, you know, again, my upbringing is that, you know, you should be glad that he hasn't, you know, smote you today.
Right,
and
right.
So you really can't call on him and you know, say, now you better start, you know, holding up your end. I just don't think it's right.
But at least in that first psalm, doesn't he think that he has done
the right things, and he has, and it's, it still needs help. God fixed it. I think he thinks he's done. He's a pretty good guy. He's done what he's supposed to do.
That's called pride.
That's what he's talking about. He's saying, I've done all these things right. I've done all this stuff. Now, where are you?
Yeah, and even in that first psalm, I did notice there is, in that verse 2, I mean, I think he says, for none are righteous. For none is wholly righteous. And I think that's implicating himself in that. Other psalms I was looking at too, I mean, do say, go ahead, God, search me. There's nothing wrong in me, and it's all your problem. I've held up my end. So it is, you hear both voices in there, I think.
So how does Brueggemann deal with this? How does he say it is an act of faith to go ahead and act that way?
He argues that it's an act of faith because it's being honest about the present and trusting that God can enact a new future out of it. That it's saying there's an act of faith in saying, things are terrible right now. I see injustice and pain in my own life, and I believe that it's worth bringing that to God, trusting that God can make something new of that. I think it does get touchy with some of the language of how we're expressing that. But I'm interested in that way of seeing these, I think. Yeah.
I have a question. I just looking through these psalms and
yep.
some of the others. God is frequently addressed, of course, as God, Elohim, and sometimes as Lord, the Yahweh.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if you or any of the commentaries give any insight, if we call God Lord or we call him God, is there anything going on that can be helpful for our lament?
Using the
That's a question.
Right. So the question sort of whether the proper name for God, Yahweh, is being used, or whether this more general term of Elohim. I don't know the answer to that. Do you have any?
No, generally, at least the Jewish thought, Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh, we're not really supposed to say Yahweh. We don't even know how it was pronounced, whether it was Yahweh or something else. But traditionally, that's how Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh got identified with Lord, because it usually was replaced by pronouncing the word Adonai, which does mean Lord, and my Lord, to be exact. But usually that responds to God's attributes of mercy and compassion, and which is why I guess Lord also became the name that usually quite often in Christian thinking refers to Jesus, whereas Elohim or Eloheinu refers to the God of justice and the God who righteousness, etc., and all that kind of stuff. So you can see why Elohim became in Christian thinking the Father, and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh became, which actually in Jewish thinking is actually above all Lord. When you say Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, it's actually above all concepts of God, all different attributes. It's exactly what it's related to in the Hebrew language. It's just being. But as I said, it became pronounced as Adonai, so it didn't take on this.
Right.
And in Christian language, that became the Son. Mm-hmm. You see, I'm very good at seeing ways that Jewish concepts kind of, more so than a lot of Jews, kind of parallel Christian concepts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm interested in the similarities sometimes.
Yeah. Well, any concluding reflections? We've got the, I know, coffee time, so, yep.
Jesus prayed the Psalms on the cross. My God, why are you forsaking me? Psalm 22, and Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Psalm 31.
Yep.
So, to me, unfaith is walking away from God under sorrow and anguish. It's turning your back on God. Faith is shaking your fist at God, crying out to God, reasoning with God, pleading with God, praising God. I mean, this is what Jesus did on the cross.
in the moment, keeping a vital relationship.
In the moment his enemies were brutalizing him, he faced his father and continued talking to his father. That was faith, as opposed to one of the other guys on the cross next to him turned his back and walked away.
Yeah,
that's unfaith.
Yeah.
I don't think it's faithless to volumize your lament with God. I think that's an act of faith.
Well, thank you.
At least there's somebody to talk to.
At least there's someone to talk to.
I was thinking as a psych mental health nurse, it feels like in that first song, well, in the other one too, we're getting it all out there.
Yep.
We're getting it out of our insides, and that's a very therapeutic thing.
Yep.
And when you talked about the grieving process that you're going through, because I had something similar, it's just real healthy.
Yep. Place to start from a place of honesty. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thanks to all of you, and we'll see you again tomorrow.